From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today, we continue with our Coastline candidate interviews, and on this edition, we're talking with David Rouser. He's North Carolina's Republican congressman from Johnston County in the 7th District. He served one term and is seeking a second. Before winning a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives, David Rouser served in the North Carolina Senate for two terms, representing the 12th District. North Carolina's 7th Congressional District stretches from the southeastern coast of North Carolina and encompassing Brunswick, New Hanover, and Pender counties, west to the more rural Columbus, Sampson, Wayne, and Duplin counties. The district also includes portions of Johnston and Bladen County. 70% of voters in the 7th District are white, 21% are black, and 9% identify as Hispanic. Registered Democrats make up the lion's share of the district at 44%. Republicans claim 32.5%, and unaffiliated voters make up 23%. It was 2012 that David Rouser challenged Democratic incumbent Congressman Mike McIntyre for the seat in the 7th District. Rouser lost that election, but it was a close one. 2 years later, McIntyre decided not to run again, and David Rouser won the seat in a race against Democrat Jonathan Barfield. This year, he faces Democratic challenger Wesley Castine, whom we met on the October 6th edition of Coastline. Representative David Rouser, welcome to Coastline.
Great to be with you.
This show is pre-recorded, so we will not have live input from the audience today. We did, however, solicit questions before this taping, and we'll incorporate those as we can. Congressman Rouser, in past campaigns, you've talked about your time in Washington, D.C. as an aide to longtime Senator Jesse Helms, one of the fathers of the conservative movement. And you've characterized those years as formative years for you in terms of helping to inspire your commitment to public service and to the intent of the Constitution. Now that you've served as a congressman for one full term, how different is Washington, D.C., and the process compared to how it was when you were there in Senator Helms' office?
Yeah, it's amazing how different it is. 10 years can make a big difference. I left Capitol Hill in the Bush administration in 2006. I had been with Senator Helms from 1995 to 2000, then came back at his request to help him out again in 2001, 2002. He retired, and Senator Elizabeth Dole succeeded him, and she asked me to stay on board with her to help see a few things through, and was with her until the spring of 2005, and at that point I moved over to the Bush administration. When I was sworn in, January will be 2 years ago, there were, I think, several things that I noticed that were different. Number one, we had the largest majority in the House since 1928. In terms of number of Republicans, 247 of us. That's still well short of a supermajority, which is what you need to override a presidential veto. That number is 290. But nonetheless, we had the largest number of House Republicans since 1928. The other thing that struck me is outside groups have so much more influence over the election process today than they did when I was with Senator Helms. That has had, I think, a very interesting effect on politics, on how my colleagues make their decisions in terms of votes. It takes a good 2 years to raise the $1.5-2 million that on average you need as a candidate to run for office. Well, when you have outside groups that can come in and spend $500,000, $1 million, $2 million, whatever they choose to spend, in a very short period of time, that really has a very adverse effect on the Democratic process, and so I think our campaign finance laws need to be opened up so that candidates themselves can raise the amount of money they need to raise and really get out there and get their message out there without having so much influence, from outside groups.
When you say opened up, what do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that is basically enable the candidates to raise as much as they can raise from any individual or any group.
So lifting any kind of cap.
Lift any kind of cap. You may want to have a cap at a certain level, but make it so, and this would really help challengers, make it so a challenger, for example, could go and say raise $25,000 apiece from four different people. All of a sudden, they've got $100,000. Then they've got the seed money to really go out and get their message out there and compete with an incumbent that has all the name ID. And see, if you direct the money through the candidate, all of a sudden the outside groups have very little influence, and the candidates would have much more control over their campaign and over their political destiny, so to speak. So it's a bit counterintuitive. People think, oh, you don't want people buying elections.
Exactly. But, that's exactly what comes to mind, and that's exactly why those caps were put in place in the first place.
Well, see, the way it is now, all it does is advantage the incumbent, because guess who has all the name ID? It's the incumbent. And that when you have a cap at $2,700 for a federal race, for a primary, for example, that means you've got to spread your net so much further and wider to raise that amount of money. Well, a challenger typically can't, because they don't have that kind of network. They don't have that kind of name ID. But if you open it up and you enable a candidate, whether an incumbent or a challenger, to raise any amount that an individual wants to give, have it all disclosed, of course. Disclosure is incredibly important. Have it all disclosed. Have it immediately disclosed so that everybody knows what's going on. See, what happens is that incumbent, money only helps you so much, because you reach that point of diminishing marginal return. For example, my name ID in this district is probably about 97-98%. And most people in the district know of my name, and a lot of people in the district, probably 75-80%, have a pretty strong feeling about me one way or the other. They either like me or they don't like me.
And that's not going to change.
Great example here, Jeb Bush. Had all the money in the world. Mm-hmm. Didn't do him one bit of good, because everybody had already made up their mind about a Bush. Now, perhaps if Jeb's last name was different, his money might have had a different effect. But as it worked out, it didn't matter that he had the vast majority of cash as compared to any other candidate.
So if you are elected to a second term, will you be sponsoring legislation that would open up some of that ability to fundraise directly?
Well, I don't know that I would personally sponsor it, but I certainly think that we need to start talking about it. I certainly think that it would improve the process when the candidates have a direct say and a direct, much more of a direct voice, in the fundraising process. For example, you campaign, you work really hard for 2 years, you have an outside group come in, either for you or against you. And in some cases, I'll use an example. In my case, I had some outside groups come in for me, but they ran ads that I didn't like.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us an example?
And
of
in
an
fact,
ad?
I don't think those ads probably helped me.
Are you talking about the 2014 election?
The 2014 primary. Yeah, mm-hmm. But I had no control over what that outside group was doing. In their minds, they thought that they were helping me, but I don't think that they did. I think I lost votes over a lot of their ads.
But I
still won in a major way.
You did, and but, it doesn't help necessarily to disavow those ads, because people say, right, but those ads are still running and it benefits
well,
you.
Well, yeah, and of course, here's the other thing is, people would look at you and say, well, what do you mean you didn't have any say over that ads? Because it's very counterintuitive to them. But the fact of the matter is, you don't. By law, you can't have any coordination whatsoever.
Well, when you talk about your name recognition in this race, it's true. Ballotpedia calls this, and Ballotpedia is not alone in this, but this is widely viewed as a Republican safe seat. How is that affecting your campaigning this year?
Well, obviously, I've been on the campaign trail for a while. I've had a lot of money spent on my behalf. I've had a lot of money spent against me. I've raised a lot of money myself and, run a lot of ads. And we've done, in my estimation, we put together a really strong staff, both in Washington and throughout the district. We've been very, as responsive to the needs of every constituent that came our way with a legitimate need. We've been as responsive as we possibly could be. And from that standpoint, you know, we built a good name and a good reputation throughout the district. So that translates, you know, not only into greater name ID, but that also translates into people's impressions of you one way or the other.
And how much would you estimate, because we have heard that legislators need to spend such a large percentage of their time raising money, campaigning through the entire term, this short 2-year term that you have. How much of your time do you think you've had to spend campaigning, fundraising? And I'm flipping those.
Right,
I'm using
right.
them synonymously.
Now, I understand. Now, you spend a good bit of time. Now, you don't spend 30 hours a week like I saw in a recent TV program that was aired, 60 Minutes or something like that. That is not the norm. You probably spend 2 or 3 hours a week on the phone, you know, raising money, which is nothing close to 30 hours a week. However, it's a constant effort because you can't raise $1.5 million or $2 million in 2 months or 3 months.
This is something that always has to be on your mind.
It is a daily, weekly, monthly effort. And here's the other thing. See, if you were to open up the system and allow individuals to give what they wanted to give to a candidate, have it completely, totally disclosed, it wouldn't take all that time. And as long as it's completely disclosed, I think it would be very, very healthy. Incumbents would not be able to skate right on into, skate right on into office like they do now.
Well, let's play for a second.
When they have a challenger could raise the amount of money they need to raise to actually compete.
When you go to Washington, so many people go to Washington in their first term, you know, with idealistic ideas about what they're going to do and how it's going to work. And we are about to end this first segment, so I'm going to have to finish this question when we come back, but want to follow up on that idea about campaign contributions and how they may or may not influence what you do on the Hill. You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews on 91.3 FM. Congressman David Rauser is with us today. He's the Republican incumbent who has held the seat in North Carolina's 7th District for one term. He's seeking a second. We will be right back after this 90-second break. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today, we're talking with U.S. Representative David Rauser. He's the Republican incumbent from North Carolina's 7th District, who has served one term and is seeking a second. He's facing a challenge this November by Democrat Wesley Castine. And Congressman Rauser, just before we went to break, we were talking about your desire to see restrictions lifted on a candidate's ability to raise money. You're talking about lifting caps and making it more transparent, potentially, thus making politicians more accountable for where the money comes from.
Making it more competitive.
Yes. So let's say that happens, and a special interest group, let's say an industry group, makes a very large contribution to your campaign. How are you not then obligated, even subconsciously, when you consider the law of reciprocity, even if your ethics say, I'm going to make decisions and shape policy based on what I believe in, how are you not going to ultimately do favors for that particular special interest group?
Well, I think you're looking at it through a faulty premise. You know, when I go and I cast my vote, I cast my vote based on what's in the best interest of the country, what's in the best interest of my district. And, you know, I have my philosophical viewpoints, of course. I'll give you an example. For a long time in North Carolina, and even still today, tobacco is a huge component of the economy. Well, just about every member of the North Carolina delegation, whether they're Democrat or Republican over the years, has voted in favor of tobacco. Well, and so the tobacco companies would support those who support them. And so it's not a case where, you know, a company or a PAC gives money and then a candidate or an incumbent changes their position. There's no way possible for that to happen, quite frankly, even if you were to use that as a metric, because you've got the other on the other side as well. So even if that is how people gauge their votes, there's no way they could do it for long because you've got too many countervailing forces. So what happens is, let's say if you've got a healthcare bill on the floor, well, you'll always be able to tell what the central activity of a Congress is during certain months based on the money. But it's not based on the, it's not that the money is dictating the decisions. It's that that issue is on the table, and so you'll have all the healthcare PACs come in, and they'll give to folks on both sides. So you'll see they're given at a higher level, say, for example, when you're dealing with reforms to Obamacare, or when Obamacare was on the table, I guarantee you, you could go back and look, and you'd see that the healthcare sector was piling in most of their donations in and around thereafter or before that heavy conversation, that was in front of Congress. So PACs and individuals give to people who are naturally supportive of their positions.
So you're
they
saying
they don't give to people to change a vote. I've never ever seen that happen. Now that's not to say that maybe in a specific instance it hadn't happened, but that's I've never seen that.
So the basic premise then, your point is that politicians are not compromised by large amounts of money.
I think as long as it's disclosed, they are not. Now if it's not disclosed, I could certainly see how that might be a problem. But if it's disclosed, no.
How is that different?
Oh, it's very different. If everything's disclosed and transparent, I think an individual, as a individual member, legislator, you make your votes based on your conscience, based on what you think's right for the country and right for the district. And those groups that are opposed to you, they're not going to give you money. The ones that do support your point of view, they do give you money.
Why do you want this job again? What's your agenda for a second term?
Well, we have got to get this economy turned around. We got to rebuild our stature in the world. I have worked very, very hard to push legislation that I thought was in the best interest of the country. We have a system of government, however, that makes it very difficult to get anything done unless you have a chief executive in the White House and a supermajority in the U.S. Senate that will go along with your ideas. Our system of government is designed to basically protect the voice of the minority. And by protecting the voice of the minority, what I mean is they made it difficult to get things done because they wanted to force consensus. And if you couldn't get a consensus, they wanted to force compromise. I'm talking about our founders. And if you couldn't get a compromise, it's designed that nothing happened. And so if we're going to have the major change that we need to move the country forward, you have to have a united government. You can't have a divided government like we have today, where one party controls the White House and one party controls the Senate, or has a majority in the Senate and a majority in the House. You need to have like minds on all sides. It's kind of like a tricycle or a three-wheeler.
Or a willingness to compromise. This is something that we've seen evaporate in the...
Well, it has, and I blame that, quite frankly, at the foot of the president. When Bill Clinton got shellacked in the 1994 election, he moved to the center. He went to Capitol Hill and negotiated with Bob Dole and negotiated with Newt Gingrich. They passed welfare reform. They passed a balanced budget. They did a lot of good things because Bill Clinton was willing to move to the center. This president has not been willing to do that. When he got shellacked in the 2010 elections and lost control of the House of Representatives, he said, you know what, it really doesn't matter. I have a pen and a phone. And what he meant by that was I can go and issue all these executive orders and rules and regulations, which, by the way, we as members of Congress have no vote on. And it's part of the reason why I think you're seeing such a political upheaval in the country.
So are you laying the responsibility for congressional gridlock at the president's feet? It's one guy's fault?
Hey, he's the guy with the megaphone. He's the guy with the leadership stick. And I can tell you there's a number of Democrats that are looking forward to a new administration, whether it's a Donald Trump or a Hillary Clinton, because he has not been willing to work with Congress. For example, we had the big debate on trade adjustment assistance. Obama had 80 votes in the House for trade adjustment assistance. He came down to the House chamber, met with the Democrat conference. When he left, he walked out with 40 votes. He lost 40 votes because of the way he treated his own members. You know, he was very demeaning, belittling, and basically it's his way or the highway, and he's not willing to work with anybody on either side of the aisle. So yes, I do put a lot of the blame in terms of the toxic atmosphere that we have in Washington at the feet of the president because he's not been willing to work with us and compromise. When he got shellacked in 2010, he should have taken note of that and said, you know what, maybe Obamacare isn't exactly what the rest of the country wants. Maybe we need to make some modifications to it. Did they ever do that? No. When he lost in the Senate in the 2012 in the 2014 elections, has he moved to the center even more? Any at all? No, not at all.
Well, let's talk about what you can do to change that. It's very likely that you will be reelected. Congressman David Rauser, how can you contribute to changing that vitriolic, divisive tone on Capitol Hill?
Well, you know, one thing I think you learn early on, and this just learn early on in life, is that there's only so much that you can change. You know, 99.9% of what we deal with every day is not of our own making. But what we do control is ourselves, what we say, our actions. I'm one of 435 in the House. So I've got to find 217 other people that agree with me in order to move my bill forward and get it out of the House.
And how do you get people to agree with you?
Well, the problem is not necessarily getting it out of the House. The problem is getting it through the Senate. There you got to have 60 votes. And say, for example, this year you've got 54 Republicans. That means Mitch McConnell, majority leader, has to go find six Democrats to vote with him. Well, it's hard to find six Democrats that will vote with the 54 Republicans to get the 60 votes that you need.
Part of that vitriolic, yeah. Very divided.
And so on the big ticket items in particular, that's the challenge that you run into. Now, items like the Water Resources Development Act, where I have specific provisions included in that bill to take care of our beaches here in southeastern North Carolina. Well, that's not so much a partisan issue. I have good relationships on both sides. That bill passed by wide margin. Wide bipartisan margin. We got a version of the bill through the Senate. We're going to go to conference, get all that worked out, send it to the president, and he'll likely sign it. So it's your big ticket issues of tax reform, health care reform, welfare reform, rules and regulations, where you have more of a philosophical divide.
Right.
And
some of that is just ideology.
Yeah, that's right. And that's why that's why these elections matter. Whoever wins the presidency is going to determine what direction this country goes in.
So let's talk about the presidency. We've heard all about Donald Trump's repeated claims that the election is rigged. We heard from one listener, Margaret, who is concerned about those allegations and what that could mean. Running mate Mike Pence, I think this was just last night, promised that he and Donald Trump will respect the will of the American people and will absolutely accept the results on Election Day. Not long after that, I think just hours later, Trump tweeted, "The election is absolutely being rigged by dishonest and distorted media pushing crooked Hillary, but also at many polling places." And this concerns listener Margaret. She is not alone in this. She says Trump's claims undermine the fabric of American democracy and destabilize American government. So she asks, number one, are you willing to state publicly that the U.S. election process is fair and that you will accept the results of the election both here in North Carolina and nationally?
Well, I think we always have accepted that the election results were accurate and fair. I think you can enhance that, though, if you have voter ID, which has been struck down here in the state of North Carolina. All it takes is, as long as you have the right name and right address, you can go vote for anybody. And that's I think, problematic.
And that law was deemed by a court as going after African Americans with almost surgical precision.
Well, I don't see how anybody can disagree with having a voter ID. You have to have an ID to do anything, to check into a hotel, to get on an airplane, whatever it may be, they ask for your ID. And I don't know of anything more important and more precious than an individual's right to vote. And I don't know of anything more important than protecting the integrity of that vote.
So
when you have other people that come in with the correct name and address, and there's no photo ID, and it's Susie voting for Shirley instead, you know, that compromises everybody else's vote, and that's not right. And there's no way to know how often that has happened here in the state of North Carolina before voter ID. Of course, as you mentioned, the courts have struck that down. But that gets back to this presidential election and who we nominate to the courts. I'm a strong supporter of Donald Trump as our nominee and Mike Pence as his running mate, because I'm looking at the big picture. I'm looking at the future of the country. Words, comments, no matter how repulsive, no matter how regrettable, are not going to ruin the future of this country. What will ruin the future of the country is Hillary Clinton and a very liberal Supreme Court.
And those xenophobic, misogynistic words from the mouth of a world leader, does that not give you pause?
What gives me pause is a very liberal Supreme Court that will jeopardize our religious liberties, that will jeopardize our Second Amendment rights, that will approve all these rules and regulations that our current administration has put in place, that the court system for the time being has put a halt to. For example, executive amnesty. Another example is Waters of the USA, which would absolutely ruin the 7th Congressional District. The entire district could easily be classified as a wetland. Can you imagine what that would do to our farmers and our business owners and home builders, realtors, et cetera? That's what gives me pause. Again, words and comments, as regrettable as they may be and as disgusting as they may be from 10 years ago, 11 years ago, 30 years ago, 8 years ago, that's not going to ruin the country. What will ruin the country is keeping in place these rules and regulations, having a very liberal Supreme Court that jeopardizes our religious liberties, our Second Amendment rights, keeping in place Obamacare, which is destroying the healthcare system and certainly not helping our economy one bit at all either.
So what needs to happen with Obamacare? I remember in 2014, when I asked you then about your primary agenda, you said that the repeal of Obamacare was project number one. Do you believe that we should have some kind of universal health care available to people who can't afford it?
Well, I think we have to understand that the only way you're going to get the very best product for the lowest possible price is to have competition and transparency. We have neither in our health care system today or in the insurance markets today. When an individual goes to the doctor, they have no idea how much that doctor visit cost. That's part of the ever-increasing escalation of cost of health care.
So what kind of plan would you support, if any?
Well, what we have put forward as a House Republican conference, and folks can go and find it at better.gop, www.better.gop, are a list of principles and ideas that we believe would substantially improve our health care system. First, though, you have to repeal Obamacare. What do you do after you repeal it? Well, you enable health insurance to be sold across state lines to create more competition. You enable people to set up health savings accounts so they can save money tax-free to take care of...
Don't those exist now?
In some cases, but not for everybody, no. If you're a government employee, you have the benefit of a flexible spending account. In certain other cases, you have the benefit of a health savings account, but it's not wide open where anybody can go and set those up today. There are certain restrictions in place, and that needs to be open and available for everybody. You need to have tort reform to cut down on lawsuit abuse as it relates to health care. You need to be able to enable our doctors to make the decisions that are necessary for their patients, not based on what the government's telling them they'll pay for and they won't pay for. Those are the type of things that we propose in our alternative package. Another key point, allow farmers, for example, to band together nationwide to purchase insurance. And as a collective group, they have the leverage to get a much, much better price. Allow realtors to band together nationwide to purchase health insurance. They get a much, much better price. Pharmacists, you name it.
Representative Rauser, during your time in the North Carolina State Senate, you helped to get a law passed in 2012, I think it was, that barred state agencies from considering accelerated sea level rise in decision making until July of this year. This was essentially a moratorium on accepting recommendations from a science panel based on their research.
Well, you had to go back and look at what they were proposing at the time. They were basically saying, here's a model, and the model assumes that the sea level, for example, here in Wilmington, would rise by 39 inches within 100 years. Well, Rachel, we just had a hurricane come through.
Mm-hmm.
Was that model correct the entire time? No. So my point is this. How are you going to make a decision 100 years from, that's based on data, based on a projection 100 years from now, when we can't even get the hurricane forecast right 6 days out, 3 days out, 2 days out? Nobody anticipated the flooding that we've had in the inland part of this district. And it's because the models are not perfect.
And that's right. But Climate Central, which is made up of scientists and science journalists, it's been cited by the Associated Press, Reuters, all the major news networks, Nightline, Time, Scientific American, National Geographic. This group just published a study that shows that over the last decade, human-driven climate change has caused 82% of the flood days in Wilmington, North Carolina. It also says that in the last decade, human-driven climate change has caused 308 out of 376 flood days for Wilmington. Has your thinking on sea level rise and climate change changed at all in the last several years?
Let's talk about our areas of expertise and everybody's role in this. I'm not a scientist. I don't pretend to be a scientist. I do know this. Scientists disagree about what is causing climate change. I do know this.
The largest part of the scientific community says man-made climate change is a thing. Do you think it's real?
Well, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're right. I was a chemistry major at NC State, and one of the things you learn early on in science is you have a hypothesis, and you keep trying to prove until it's disproven. Well, the fact of the matter is none of this is absolutely proved to be true. We don't know yet. It's all based on models. Now, here's where I am. From a public policy standpoint, I don't look at it necessarily. I don't get in the middle of the debate between the scientists. What I say from a public policy perspective is we need to be basing public policy based on what we absolutely know to be the case, not based on a hypothesis.
And I don't want to shortchange you on this answer because I know it is nuanced. There's a lot to it. So we're going to go to a break and we'll come back in 90 seconds. You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews today. Congressman David Rauser is with us. He's finishing out his first term, is seeking a second. He's facing a challenge this November by Democrat Wesley Castine. After this 90-second break, we'll return for the final segment. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. David Rauser, U.S. Representative from North Carolina's 7th Congressional District, is with us today. The 7th District includes southeastern North Carolina, Brunswick, New Hanover, and Pender counties, and it goes west to the more rural Columbus, Sampson, Wayne, and Duplin counties. The district also includes portions of Johnston and Bladen County. This entire edition of Coastline Candidate Interviews is devoted to getting to know Republican incumbent David Rauser. You can hear the interview with his Democratic challenger, Wesley Castine, at WHQR.org. And Representative Rauser, just before we went to break, you were talking about the very nuanced issue of climate change and sea level rise. Is man-made climate change real?
I don't know the answer to that. What I do know is the Earth has warmed and cooled since the beginning of time. And obviously it was warming and cooling long before the man-made combustible engine. We have volcanoes, we have all kinds of natural disasters such as forest fires, et cetera. And I'm certain all that has a lot of influence on the climate change as well. The question becomes, as a lawmaker, you're making public policy decisions. And these public policy decisions have huge impacts. They impact property rights. They impact property values. They impact whether or not you can have insurance in certain areas, for example. They impact a whole slew of things. which, because of all those individual impacts, you have community impacts. So, for example, if you're a coastal community and they're projecting that you have 39-inch increase in sea level rise in 100 years, and they make certain modifications based on that, well, all of a sudden you have property owners that lose all the value of their property. You have a tax base that declines, and the coastal community doesn't have the amount of tax revenue coming in that it once had.
It is a complicated issue, but then you can also have people building homes on areas that will flood before 100 years comes along.
Well, with everything, there is a balance, for sure. But what I'm saying, though, is it's faulty to go and make a public policy decision based on a hypothesis that has not been proven. That's the bottom line. And that has always been my position on it. Now, at some point in time, I'm sure the scientists will be able to come to an agreement about climate change, what causes it, what doesn't cause it, et cetera. But right now, there may be a consensus in some circles of what
97% of scientific climate science.
I don't know if that's 100% accurate. I know there's a lot of scientists that have real questions about these models and about the argument on the other side. And so until the day it's unanimous, where you know we can actually have forecasts that we are absolutely certain are accurate, it makes it very difficult to make those public policy decisions. So my position all along has been, rather than looking at a model 100 years out, why don't we look at the trends from the past, you know, 10, 20, 30 years and going back, use the historical data to make our judgments, because we know that data is absolutely accurate because it's historical.
It's historical, but it's also based on factors that are very different today in terms of carbon
emissions. See, that's a point of argument, though. And that's where we can agree to disagree. My point is, I think it's very dangerous to be making public policy decisions based on an hypothesis for the next 100 years where and we may agree to disagree on this, where there's really no true scientific certainty.
We got an email from Cape Fear Students for a Free Tibet, and this is a group that is represented at UNCW, CFCC, that's University of North Carolina at Wilmington, Cape Fear Community College, Brunswick Community College, and Mount Olive Community College. China has reportedly begun demolishing buildings at Larungar. I'm probably mispronouncing that. That's one of the largest Buddhist academies in Tibet, and that is according to UPI. The Cape Fear Students for a Free Tibet write, "This is a clear act of religious suppression on the part of the Chinese government, as well as a massive human rights violation. How does the treatment of the Tibetan people and other minorities in China affect your trade decisions, especially given that we are aware of conditions in many Chinese factories? Are human rights a deciding factor for you when voting on trade? And do you believe that North Carolina can be a champion for the Tibetan people and a more equitable relationship with the Chinese government?"
Well, first of all, I have to say the Chinese government has always been atrocious in terms of human rights violations. you know, it's a interesting dynamic. Obviously, China is a huge market for U.S. companies, for economic commerce, but their human rights abuses are well documented, and I think should be considered as part of every trade deal, and we should use every available opportunity to persuade them to change their ways. Economic opportunity as it relates to these trade negotiations. In general principle, I'm in favor of free trade, but it's got to be free and it's got to be fair. And that's one of the big points I agree with Donald Trump on, is we can't just give away the store for the sake of free trade. We need to make sure these trade agreements are fair. We need to make sure that we're getting concessions out of these communist governments that treat their citizens so horribly when it comes to human rights issues. And I've been a strong supporter of Tibet and the people there, and have great empathy for their plight. Senator Helms was a big champion of theirs as well when I was with him. And in fact, my old boss, Senator Helms, was very critical of China as it related to their human rights atrocities that you were asking me earlier, those formative years. Well, that's one of the takeaways from my years with Helms is you have what's moral and good, and you have what's immoral and bad. And, you know, we condone what we turn a blind eye to, and we can't turn a blind eye to these atrocities.
What do you think about the prospect of drilling offshore for oil and natural gas? Recently, this Mid-Atlantic region, which includes off of coastal North Carolina, was removed from the administration's plan for 2017 to 2022. Is that something you would like to see reopened? Would you support offshore drilling off the North Carolina coast?
Well, I have always been very pro-energy because I think if you have the right agriculture policy in place, you have the right energy policy in place, and you have the right infrastructure policy in place, it enables us to be exceptionally prosperous here at home and incredibly strong abroad. Energy is a key component of that. So I've always been very bullish on energy production. You also have to have a balance, of course. We have rules and regulations in place to help ensure that the environment is not compromised. Technology has come a long, long way, even since the BP issue in the Gulf. And so from a general principle standpoint, I'm supportive of all exploration, wherever it may be. Now, it has to be done in the right way, and you have to have the safeguards in place. And not only that, if we're going to do anything off the coast of North Carolina, we need to have the money stream in place to address our beach issues, our beach nourishment issues, the dredging of our inlets and our waterways. This could be an exceptional opportunity to financially secure our coastal communities long term. And of course, you always want to have every safeguard in place possible to ensure that the environment is appropriately protected. But technology is an amazing thing. It has come a long, long way, and in the industry over a long number of years has really developed and progressed in that area.
Would you support hydraulic fracturing in North Carolina?
If it's done the right way and they follow the rules and regulations as necessary, I think probably many of your listeners have heard all the negative things about fracking over the years. So much of that is so erroneous and just flat out false, particularly all the horror stories coming out of Pennsylvania. I talk to my colleagues from Pennsylvania all the time who have gone through various examples and showed me, you know, where a lot of those stories were wrong. But
how are some of those stories wrong? Can you be specific about that?
Oh, well, sure. Well, in some cases, the one most egregious case I think that I recall is where they took a lighter and lit the faucet there at the sink. And the fact of the matter is, regardless of any fracking, a gas had been in that water forever. I mean, it was not a result of the fracking, but yet fracking was blamed for it. And so that's just one example that comes to mind, because I remember that being on a number of different news programs. So the fact of the matter is, this technology has come a long, long way. You go to North Dakota, for example. That state is booming economically because of the new technological advances that enable fracking. They were able to get to shale resources in that state that they'd never been able to get to before. And even if you're an employee at McDonald's, you're making a minimum of $15 an hour. I think I saw somewhere up to $22 or $25 an hour. So that just shows you what happens when you have a thriving economy and businesses can make a profit. They hire more people. And not only do they hire more people, they can increase the pay of the employees that they have.
We've heard about a spate of earthquakes in Oklahoma, which is not a place that's known for its earthquakes, and that's been widely linked to the increase in hydraulic fracturing in that state.
Well, you know, I was talking to a colleague of mine from Oklahoma as well, because I had read that article, and this is a gentleman who's been in the House for a long time, and I asked him about that. And basically what he pointed out is there's no scientific conclusion on that at all. There's a lot of disagreement to the extent that it is related to fracking. They believe that it's probably from the fact that you have, under the EPA regulations, you have to take the water and pump it back into the ground. And so they're starting to think that it's because of the EPA regulations, ironically, that if there's any correlation with earthquakes and fracking, that may be the reason where they're pumping that used water.
The wastewater.
The wastewater, yes. I was trying to think of the accurate name for it, where they're pumping that back into the ground, whereas before they didn't. See, they've been fracking in Oklahoma for years, years and years and years. And the earthquakes that they're having now seem to be much more accelerated, much more frequent than what they've ever had before. But they're very skeptical that it's directly related to the traditional fracking method itself. But what has changed is the pumping of that wastewater back into the ground. And so to the extent that it's related to fracking, they think it may be related to that. And that goes back to an EPA regulation. But again, there's no consensus or no scientific evidence of exactly what all this is. The other thing is the Earth has been changing for years and years and years and years. And who knows, the hurricanes, earthquakes, et cetera, a lot of that, I think there's only one person that understands, and that's the Lord above.
You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. Today we're talking with U.S. Representative David Rauser. He's the Republican incumbent from North Carolina's 7th Congressional District. He is seeking his second term. David Rauser, since your time in the state Senate, you've been a champion of regulatory reform, and that is actually a sweeping idea that encompasses a lot of specific points. You talk about the right safeguards being in place for, say, offshore drilling. Mm-hmm. And hydraulic fracturing. Are those two ideas conflicting, the notion of getting rid of what you call red tape that hamstrings business and having regulations in place that protect the environment?
Well, let me make it very simple. We all need to have rules of the road. For example, we all need to know that you drive on the right-hand side of the road, not the left-hand side of the road. We all need stop signs at certain places and stop lights at certain places. Well, you know, and it's appropriate on certain roads to have a speed limit at certain levels. Where we are today with our regulatory regime is we basically have a stop sign or stop light every 10 feet. And that it makes it very, very onerous for business. So here's where I am. There's a balance to all this. You need to have rules of the road. People need to know what side they need to be driving on. They need to be taught correctly, and those laws need to be enforced. But you don't need a stop sign every 10 feet, and that's basically what our regulatory apparatus is today.
So if you didn't have to build consensus then, what is one big regulation that you would just remove, if you could, that exists right now?
Well, all the rules and regulations directly tied to Obamacare. I mean, if I could repeal any one thing, it would be all those rules and regulations directly tied to Obamacare so that we could have patient-centered reform again, patient-centered health care again.
There is always criticism of the current administration and the prevailing party, the majority. We know that. That's just what Americans do, is criticize whoever is in office.
That's easy to do.
Yes. Approval ratings of Congress are not exactly at historic lows, but they're close, according to Gallup. The last poll conducted in September, a month ago, shows that 76% of Americans disapprove of the way Congress is doing its job. 20% approve, 5% have no opinion. Why do you think people feel that way, and is it deserved?
Well, I think it's because of the media attention. I think it's because of the political divide that we have in the country. I don't know that Congress has ever had a good approval rating going back to the founding of the country.
There was a time, though, in the mid-80s. I looked at this data. There was a time when Congress actually had a very high approval rating.
Well, that was probably after the passage of Reagan's tax cuts. And because Congress came together under a strong leader to get a monumental achievement done. And not only did they pass the tax cut package, they reformed and saved Social Security for a number of years. And again, it was because you had a good, strong leadership in the White House working with members of Congress to get that done. So if I had to guess, it was probably on the heels of the tax cut package, and it was probably on the heels of Social Security reform, which saved Social Security, long term. And then, of course, we need to have that kind of leadership today.
That's this edition of Coastline. Representative David Rauser, it's been a pleasure having you with us today.
Great to be with you.
Remember, one-stop voting begins October 20th and runs through November 5th. Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Producer is Isabel Shepherd. Technical director is Ken Campbell. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at our website, whqr.org, or get the podcast from the iTunes Store. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.